I mentioned the gold mine in Guinea. I think the family I work for, we had invested about $150 million to become the biggest shareholder of that mine. It was called Kru Gold. And, you know, it was an unstable regime where it was a coup. And then this army guy who took control, he was shot in the head. And eventually there were so many hiccups operationally.
Hello, fellow risk takers, and welcome to my worst investment ever. Stories of loss to keep you winning. In our community, we know that to win in investing, you must take risk, but to win big, you've got to reduce it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm on a mission to help 1 million people reduce risk in their lives. And I want to thank all my guests from Norway for joining the mission. Fellow risk takers, this is your worst podcast host, Andrew Stotz from A Stotz Academy, and I'm here with featured guests, Austin Kalaklev. Austin, are you ready to join the mission?
Yeah, thanks for inviting, Andrew.
Yeah, in fact, I was just looking at our email communication. It's been a long time trying to get you on this show, so I appreciate
it. Yeah, it's been a bit busy lately, but now I'm free, so now I could take the opportunity.
Yeah.
Some good deals and some bad deals, maybe.
I think that we're going to have some fun going through it. So let me just briefly introduce you to the audience. Austin's the outgoing CEO of a company called Flex LNG and Advance Gas. He's got prior experience as CFO of other companies, and he's been involved in this industry, let's say, for many, many years. So, Austin, why don't you take a minute and tell us what is the unique value that you have been bringing to this wonderful world?
Yeah, thank you. No pressure on that one. Also, I've been doing shipping and energy, I would say, now for 20 years. Worked for three different self-made entrepreneurs, three families, basically. First one, Jens Ultvedtmo, who took over the Knutsen Shipping Company when it failed in the 1980s. So I was CFO for him, and I'm still on that board, which is a kind of industrial investment company. And then I joined another family, the Seglem family, who now today is the sponsor of the Knutsen company, where I was CFO and also chairman of the MLP, general partner of the MLP, Knut Offshore Partner, listed in New York. And then the last 7.5 years, I've been running two shipping companies, Flex LNG, which we listed in US in 2019, and then Avance Gas, which I've been running now the last 3 years on the side, where we today actually declared our last dividend. So we're kind of winding up that business, and that also felt a good time for me to step out and do something new.
Mm. And what has changed in the industry, you know, from when you first started to where things are now? I'm curious, like, is it the size of vessels, or is it the type of gas, or is it the ports, or I mean, what are some of the things that you've seen, the changes that have been happening?
If we look at shipping then, firstly, of course, I've been involved in a lot of other industries like oil services, restaurants, mining, bioethanol, and and a lot of retail and real estate. But if we look at shipping, I think the biggest drivers the last couple of years been, of course, the shale revolution in US, which suddenly made US a big exporter of hydrocarbons rather than being the biggest importer. And then the flip side has been China becoming the biggest importer. So that has changed the dynamics of the shipping world for most segments, being, you know, the container trade. It started with the container trade with China entering into WTO. And then US becoming an exporter, biggest exporter of LPG by far, biggest exporter of LNG, and they are growing in both segments. And then also oil, where we also see US exporting crude oil. So that's a big change. I think also after the great financial crisis, 2008 to 11, it was here in Europe with the PIGS crisis. We have also seen banks becoming more reluctant to lend to the sector. European banks, especially then German banks, which all more or less went bankrupt, they've been stepping out of the sector. The Chinese been entering, meaning that, you know, the banks are more reluctant to lend, which means that you need to have bigger clients. So the companies are getting bigger. There are more regulatory costs of complying with all these new rules coming out of both EU and the IMO, which means that you need scale. Capital markets also like scale. You know, they don't want to be investor in companies with $200-300 million market cap. They want to have $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion market cap in order to make it interesting. So these are, you know, the biggest drivers, I would say, in the shipping world, together, of course, with technology. But technology is always changing.
Mm. And what would you say is the future? I mean, like, for instance, we saw with the Russian invasion of Ukraine as an example, shifted all of that oil and gas coming out of Russia going directly into Europe as an example. We see China trying so hard to try to transition onto nuclear energy and any other renewable types of energy. We see deals, for instance, happening in currencies outside of the US dollar between Iran and China as an example. I'm originally American, but I've lived out of America longer than I lived in America. So I'm kind of watching from far away. But I'm just curious, is there any trends or thoughts that you have about what's the future in this space?
It's a couple of items there. You mentioned Chinese working outside of the dollar, and we do see this. China has really reduced the holdings of treasury or government bonds, which is one of the reasons why I think the Chinese banks have been quite aggressive in also lending to the shipping sector and other sectors like the Belt and Road and all that stuff, because they don't really want to have the kind of assets tied up in U.S. government bonds and being pressured by the U.S. government. So they rather want to recycle money into development banks and commercial banks where they can lend so they can have mortgage in a ship, which is much harder for the U.S. government to kind of confiscate it. Like we've seen with Russia now after the invasion of Ukraine, they really kind of lost a lot of money because the Western government have poisoned those funds like they've done in Iran and Venezuela back in the past. And it's also one of the drivers why gold passed $3,500 per troy ounce recently. You know, I remember when gold went above $1,000, we were, the family I worked for, we were biggest investor in a gold mine in Guinea. And, you know, $1,000 was a, you know,
unbelievably
high price. And now it's $3,500. So that's one driver. We see China wanted to invest more in direct assets. In terms of the Russia, they have been managing to turn out barrels much better than we thought. We thought with the sanctions they would have to decline the production. They haven't really, but this changed the trade path where the oil is flowing. And typically what you've seen is oil flowing from Russia to India, Brazil, China, and then actually being refined and turning back into Europe. So it's been very good for those people with a product tanker. Mm. And actually tanker market is quite good these days.
And one of the things that, if you look at the map and you look at the Straits of Malacca as an example near Singapore, you know, at the edge of Singapore and Malaysia, it's such a pinch point for travel of natural gas, of oil, and all of that thing. And some people would make the argument that the U.S. has the power to shut that down. And if they could, then that could put a crimp on the access to the markets of China. Of course, on the other side, you could argue that China is trying to diversify and get pipeline gas, and they're trying to get away from, you know, oil and gas. But I'm just curious if you had any thoughts about, like, the movement of gas and oil throughout the world and, you know, what your thoughts are about it.
Yeah, of course, China is very strategic when thinking about energy security. And that's one of the reasons why they're still building coal, despite them saying that they want carbon emissions to peak by 2030. So they're still building coal. They're building nuclear on a massive scale. They are sourcing more gas from Russia, not only because of security concerns, but really because the Russians are desperate to sell gas to new buyers because the European buyers are gone. But one item which they are very dependent on is, of course, crude oil, which, of course, they are boosting domestic production of both natural gas and oil, but still they are by far the biggest importer. And as you said, with the Navy US have, they could block it. And that's why you also see the Chinese building a lot of naval ships. And then today have in numbers more naval ships than the US, which is also one of the reasons why Donald Trump wants to reboot U.S. naval capacity to build more ships, and you have these tariffs and port fees on ships which are not domestically built.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting watching all this go on, and I appreciate you sharing some of your thoughts on it, having had a lot of experience throughout the years in that space. So, but now it's time to share your worst investment ever, and since no one goes into their worst investment thinking it will be, tell us a bit about the circumstances leading up to it, and then tell us your story.
It's a difficult question. I haven't really prepared on it. I've been part of some investments which have been really bad. Most of them were back in the great financial crisis, 2008, when everything unraveled. I mentioned the gold mine in Guinea. I think the family I work for, we had invested about $150 million to become the biggest shareholder of that mine. It was called Kru Gold. And, you know, it was an unstable regime. It was a coup. And then this army guy who took control, he was shot in the head. And eventually there were so many hiccups operationally. So eventually, I think that $150 million turned out to be like $3 million when we sold the last share. So everything more or less was lost. I've also been involved in bioethanol in Brazil, where we invested probably like $300 million into a bioethanol plant in Brazil, where also when suddenly during the great financial crisis, we had to restructure the whole company. And I had to go to the US talking to bondholders, getting them to either choose whether to become shareholders or take a very big hit on their bond loans.
And what did they end up choosing?
They, of course, chose the money because they got 45 cents on the dollar, which at that time was fantastic because everybody wanted cash at that time.
Okay. So, interesting. You have any other stories? Those are pretty powerful.
Yeah. Now, of course, I've also been involved in, you know, mining seems to be a disaster. So I've also been involved in a nickel mine in the Philippines, where we basically lost everything as well. This also around 2008-11 window. I've been involved. We were going to build a FPSO, basically a floating production ship for oil. This is like 10 years ago. Our budget was $280 million. I think we ended up at $500 million for that building project and also being 1.5 years late. So, of course, those projects are everything. Once you're getting into mining, you know, usually there's this saying that, you know, a miner is like it's a hole in the ground and a cheat on top of it. So mining is a difficult business. Offshore business, we talked before the show about the drilling rigs. I've been involved in drilling rigs as well. So offshore is because it can be fantastic. You can make fantastic amounts of money similar to mining. But once it stops, you usually get bust.
Mm. And, you know, it's interesting hearing these, you know, huge numbers and all that. And I would suspect that over your lifetime of in work, you created a huge amount of value. So these were some of the big losses. But I'm guessing that for the families and other investors, there was a lot more money and things that went well.
What has focused most on during the last 20 years has been shipping. So shipping is, of course, seriously cyclical. So if you find one industry which is cyclical, shipping is one of those. Where typically you have this boom and bust cycle. People, markets get good. We saw this back in 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8 until, you know, the financial crisis. People were building ship left, center, and right. You know, when the financial crisis came, the bulk market was poor from 2009 to 2019. So you had 10 years with a very poor market. So this is typically, you've seen this also in LNG. After Fukushima, you know, Japan really bought a lot of LNG. And then people started ordering a lot of LNG ships, a bit similar to what has happened today.
Mm.
And then a lot of these projects were for new export capacity was delayed, and you had a really, really terrible market for LNG shipping in 2014, 15, 16, 17. However, the kind of the down cycle there was shorter because you have a high growth of the market. So the kind of the trend growth takes you out of that depression quicker. For dry bulk, where you have a lot less growth, so it takes longer time to get out of a situation with oversupply and typically involves a lot of scrapping of older ships.
Mm.
So today we are a bit in the same picture with LNG ships, where you had this boom after the Russia invasion of Ukraine, where LNG prices went to the moon. People ordered too many ships. New export projects are delayed. And we have probably the worst LNG shipping market ever now. So we started to falling off a cliff last year. It's been continuing this year. It probably will continue next year. And of course, one of the reasons why in Flex LNG, we took out a lot of long-term charters ahead of this, because we saw that the order book was swelling too big. And we locked up more or less all our ships on long-term charters and have about 60 years of minimum charter backlog, which takes you through this process where you have too many ships and where you probably need to scrap some ships.
Mm. Yeah, shipping is such a cyclical. I mean, we have some shipping companies here in Thailand that I covered as an analyst, and it's just incredible. I think the whole thing about shipping is you got to like be able to survive the whole cycle, because if you get knocked out at the bottom, then you never get the upside.
No. So in the other shipping company I've been running, Avance Gas, we've done a bit different. So there's really two ways to capture the upside. You can either sell your ships, because once market is good, asset prices increases. It has a lot, great value having a ship in the market, making super profit. The other way is to charter the ships out on long-term charter and lock in that super profit, which is what we've done in Flex,
right?
Because it's not really a very liquid secondhand market. For Avance Gas, where we're doing LPG freight, it's a bit different. It's not really feasible to get those long-term charters. So instead of doing that, we sold off all the ships. So altogether, we sold off 23 ships, 20 ships just last year. We took the money and we paid out everything as dividend. So for 2024, we paid out $1 billion of dividend. And last 3 years, we paid out $1.3 billion of dividend. And then we closed the shop. That's it. So you have to be very disciplined when you are in a cyclical industry. You have to have a view on where is the market going and how can I adapt to that.
You know, it's interesting when you look at a lot of great investors, they end up holding companies that are consumer companies because they're not as cyclical. And so you end up, like, investors end up in these, I would say, much easier type of companies to invest in. But I'm curious, out of these different experiences and over your career, how would you describe the lessons that you've learned?
I think I touched upon it. You know, you have shipping, it's really hard to be kind of have a strategy. We do see some companies having this strategy that by 5 years, we're going to have twice as many ships or something like that, which doesn't really work when you have such a dynamic industry. You really have to think about adapting. It's more about adapting and being tactics rather than strategy, where you have to think about where is the market going? Where do I think the market will be in 2 years' time? Should I lock in some long-term charter? Should I sell some of the ships and kind of adapt to the market all the time as you get, every day you get new information. And suddenly some people are putting in a big contract for 20 new ships. And that's going to change maybe some of the market outlook. So you really need to adapt all the time. Of course, you have to always focus on running your ships efficiently. If you're not running your ships efficiently, you're going to lose out anyway. So it's like a critical success factor. You have to really be able to run your ships well. And then it's about timing. So shipping is a lot about market timing, I would say. And those people who have made it big, like the biggest shareholder of both Frontline, Flex LNG, Avance Gas, John Fredriksen, he's been in the business for 60 years. And one of the reasons why he's still there and the most successful is his ability to time the market. And of course, you saw the same with Onassis back in the days. He was almost bankrupt. And then the Suez crisis came in 56. And suddenly, within a short window of time, he became the richest guy in the world. Because with the Suez Canal closed, freight rates went to the moon. And he had all his ships open.
It's incredible. So three things that you mentioned, it's hard to set long-term strategy because you've got to adapt to what's happening in the market. And then you also talked about the operational part about you got to run ships efficiently or else you're going to miss, you know, the core aspect of what you're doing. And then there's this timing aspect, which makes this industry so much more challenging. Anything else you would add? Those three things I think are pretty much sum it up.
I think you have to be knowledgeable about technology, because technology is changing quite often in shipping, even though it seems like a very conservative industry. You know, you have new ship types, you have new engines, and, you know, suddenly you have these shifts where you get the eco ships, for example, which is consuming less fuel, and that makes them a lot more competitive in the business. In LNG, you have had kind of three different technology changes. You started with steam engines, which, of course, most people understand is not very efficient. Then going to diesel electric engines, and then eventually going to modern diesel two-stroke engines, which basically reduce your fuel consumption per cargo lifted by 60%. So, of course, that shipping has a lot more earnings capacity than the older type. So, in general, you need to kind of be smart about how you run a shipping company, doing it lean, follow the technology, but the kind of what differentiates the successful owners is their ability to time the market, to kind of read the market, where is it going, when should I exit, and when should I invest? And usually when you're going to invest, that's when the market is broken. But that means also it's very hard to raise capital, because most investors, they don't really want to commit to building new ships, which is going to hit the market maybe in 3 years' time when the market is broken. But that's kind of where you do the good deals with the yard. You get the lowest price, you get the best payment terms, and you can get delivery windows where you think maybe the market has come up.
Mm. I'm curious if you've ever seen any financial analysts throughout the years that you thought predicted or understood the shipping industry well, or is it very hard for an outsider like that to really get it?
In general, there's two big stock exchanges for shipping stocks today. It's New York and Oslo. Oslo, it's for more like historical reasons. This has been a shipping nation since the Vikings. So people has always been focused on shipping. We have like one of the longest coasts in the world. It's not very densely populated country. So people has always been out at sea. Actually, the first prime minister of Norway, he was a ship owner. So We have a lot of families with a lot of tradition for shipping industry, which means that people are knowledgeable about it. And you have these investor communities, which are very savvy on shipping investors. This means that shipping as part of the index in Oslo is very big. And actually being a shipping analyst in Oslo is like being almost like a superstar. You are one of the analysts that gets most in the newspapers. If you go to the US, if you're a shipping analyst, it's like you are just above the janitor in the office, because nobody is focused on shipping. People want to focus on finance and tech and these other industries. Nobody wants to focus on shipping. So that means that there's not been that many shipping analysts in the US. There are a couple which are good, you know, Omar Nokta, Chappell. But in general, you know, I see some of the Norwegian analysts like Håvardsen in Pareto, Leon in DNB, and Petter Haugen in ABG. Those guys are typically always ranked the number 1, 2, and 3 in Norway. So I tend to read those analyses coming out of them more or less every day.
I normally will ask you what's a resource that you recommend, and you're welcome to recommend one. But I also thought it would be interesting, since I train a lot of young people to become sell side analysts through my valuation masterclass. And I've had about 500 graduates. And since I was a financial analyst myself, a lot of them want to become financial analysts. And I'm just curious, like, what advice would you give to a young person that says, I want to cover the shipping industry in the future?
Yeah, no, I've been a financial analyst myself. So sometimes I very much miss sitting in Excel the whole day doing the calculation. These days I do more back of the envelope rather than the kind of nitty gritty stuff. I think you need to have an understanding of shipping, because it's not as straightforward as people think. People think it's a simple business. You take goods from A to B. So, reading up on shipping, I would say, is good. Valuation is not that difficult. It's basically a couple of ways of calculating. You have, of course, the dividend yield. Typically, when shipping companies become a bit mature and start paying good dividends, which is quite common in shipping, you can have like a dividend yield pricing, where typically you see yields of 8 to 12%. Flex, I guess, is 14% today.
Mm.
Then you have more like the NAV approach, where you take the broker values of the ships, and this is the steel value of the company. You deduct the net debt, and this is the equity value per share. Of course, that doesn't really reflect where is the market today. So if the market is really good today, you have a super profit of being in the market, or you could have like a loss. And then, of course, it's like the DCF, where you just have to make assumptions about where the rates are going, but that's really hard to do.
Yeah. That seems so. NAV approach is interesting in shipping companies. The last one I looked at many years ago, each ship was a separate company. Is that the way it's typically done?
Yeah. Typically, you ring fence one ship, one loan, one company. So, which also makes it easier to sell it. So, if you want to sell off a ship, you can either sell the ship or you can sell the company.
Got it. And then
if you're thinking like Warren Buffett, it's a bit like, you know, I read a lot of Warren Buffett books, and it's like, I think the NAV is like this safety of margin approach. So if you can screen a company, this company is being traded at 50% of NAV. So, okay, that that's interesting. Why is it traded at 50% of NAV? And there can be a couple of reasons: a bad market sentiment, poor management, reluctance to repay dividends. But if you have 50% pricing of NAV, you have kind of a big safety cushion. You know, it's limits to how bad that management can be.
Because also it means that in the worst case for the management, they could start selling their ships into the market at market price, and you would realize the NAV at the market price, assuming the ship prices aren't going up. Would that be correct?
Exactly. Like Avance Gas, we were at priced 50% of NAVs. We're starting selling ships above NAV with quite good book profit and higher than the analyst estimate. And suddenly we realized the NAV of the company plus a bit more. But that means that you have management which are shareholder oriented. So it means that the management really needs to be tied in terms of compensation to value creation for shareholders. Unfortunately, some management teams are not really tied to shareholder value creation. They are more tied to their own value creation because they get a big pay package and bonuses, almost regardless of how the shareholders are affected. So those kind of management teams you should shy away from because they're only going to enrich themselves, not the shareholders. But sometimes, you know, some of these shipping companies get hammered down even though the management is prudent and conservative and focused on value creation. And that gives you sometimes very good opportunities to make a killing. So if you look at the shipping index here in Oslo from 2001 to middle of 2024, so it's a 3.5 year stretch, it gave the same return as the Magnificent Seven.
Mm. So timing is critical.
Yeah. It hasn't been so good since last summer, though. So it's down now, and I think it's in a pace where it makes it attractive.
When we talk about NAV, first question I had about that is that when a company, let's say the chartering rates are very high, so the ship is actually quite profitable. Is that profit going into the company that owns the ship, or is it going into the main company?
Now, so typically, a ship will be owned by a company, and that company will be doing the charter contract, and money will flow into that company, and then that company will flow the money up to the parent. And then the parent can decide whether to pay that out as a dividend or pay down the leverage or just build a war chest.
Okay, so the profit, if there was an exceptional profit at a period of time, it would be accumulating into the ship company rather than the parent company that owns the ship company.
For most of the time, yes, but it could be that the owner chartered the ships out from a chartering company, so yep. they get the money into that company. But generally, it's not really a problem. These SPVs are like shell companies, typically domiciled in Marshall Islands, Cyprus, Bermuda, something like that. And really nothing happens in those companies except for owning the ship.
And it's a pass-through?
Yeah, pass-through, yeah.
Okay. And so when we calculate the NAV and the discounted NAV, is it the same as saying price to book value, or do we need to make adjustments for the value of those ships? Let's say a company owns 20 ships, where the company owns them 100%, I presume, and they're consolidating them. Is it properly reflected in book value, or do we need to make adjustments to understand the net asset value?
Yeah, it's a good question. Book value is a very poor measurement for shipping NAV because typically shipbuilding prices goes up and down a lot. So the book value reflects at what price did you purchase the ship for. So if we take Flex for example, so we bought 13 ships when prices was at rock bottom levels, like $180, $185 million. So when we then kind of capitalize those ships in the balance sheet, they are capitalized at historical cost minus depreciation. While shipbuilding prices for LNG carriers today are like $255, $260 million. So that would be the replacement cost. And kind of the long-term rates for new ships reflect the cost of new buildings. So kind of the book value is much lower than the NAV. On the contrary, you could have a situation where one shipping company buys a lot of ships on peak of the market at $260 million and then shipbuilding prices goes to $200. Then book value doesn't reflect, the book value is too high. So you really have to measure kind of the NAV towards kind of replacement cost, not historical cost.
So in other words, what you're saying is it's not like a security where we market to market. And basically, it's at the historic cost. So you've got to make an adjustment for where things are at. And if you make that adjustment and you say, okay, they got, you know, 20 tankers that are a certain size and those are a certain value, they bought those. The historical cost, let's say, is, you know, $500 million. And the market value of those ships now is $700 million. We would say that there's a $200 million potential gain if they liquidated them.
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent.
Yeah, and it's not that hard to get quotes on new building prices. Brokers have them. There are even databases like Vessel Value where you can take out the value of individual ship or kind of like a benchmark ship, like a new build, 5-year-old ships, 10-year-old ships, and then you can kind of interfere where the value should be.
And is all the value in that, in the holding company, is all the value in the ships, or is there additional value that's in the holding company?
That's always a typical good question in shipping where we have, is it a steel value or is it also a software value? Is it a brand value? I think for a general commodity shipping company where you're doing tankers, bulkers, products, hardly any software value. You are a price taker and nobody is going to pay you more freight because you have a nice brand. So it's really maybe some companies are more lean, so it could have a bit competitive advantage in being lean on costs. But my general answer is no. There are some, you know, if you look at Maersk and MSC, like big container lines, they could have a bit of a software value because they have a good booking system. They have sticky customer relationships. So there you could argue there is somewhat software value. I think maybe you could also argue that for some chemical tankers. So chemical tankers, they have a lot of contract of affreightments, which is like a volume contract. They have terminals, which also create a bit more sticky relationships with their customers, which could have a value.
Mm. And does it make sense for a management team to say, we want to build a company that has some recurring revenue being 50% of the value of our business and then the other 50% being the volatile shipping aspect? Or does that end up just not making sense and it's better just to play the cycles in a smart way?
Yeah, again, also a question that we all talk a lot about in the shipping world. So when we sold off all the ships now in Avance Gas, we also took a 12.8% shareholding in our US listed company called BVLPG. And we took those shares and we dividend them out to our shareholders because we don't want to be just like a stock where you own stock in another listed company. So we dividend all those stocks. So they have kind of a view that they want to kind of fix about 30% of their freight exposure with long-term contracts or derivatives, while they want to be open on the remaining 70%. So I think that's more a risk strategy. It depends a bit on your leverage. So if you have debt, you have interest obligation, you have repayment of debt, and you might want to secure some of that in order to attract better financing. But of course, if you don't have any debt, your cash break even is basically your OPEX. And once you're getting to those levels, a lot of people will go bankrupt. So it's really about your risk and your willingness to take risk. Of course, if you have a high conviction, like we did in Avance Gas in 2022, we looked at the market for 2023 and the market looked terrible. Expectations were so low. We said, you know, let's just lever up the company, get more debt, because if we have more cash, we can withstand a poor market. So then we went more or less everything spot. And the market took off and we were really able to capture that super profit during that year, which is something similar we did with Flex LNG back in 2021. But then you need to have a high conviction and you need to have money in the treasury in order to be able to bleed, because you might lose some money, but sometimes it's worth it. It's really when you can make the killing, when you're taking max risk when everybody's depressed.
I'm curious about your own personal investing style. Are you much more conservative or are you aggressive? You know, you mirror what you do in your career, or how do you invest personally?
Yeah, so that's what I'm doing these days after I left my day job, my two day jobs, 1st of April. So now I'm mostly investing. I would say I only feel I have an edge in shipping and energy stocks. So I don't pick other stocks, then I might as well buy a fund or an index. So in shipping, I understand, since I've been around for 20 years in that industry. So there I'm quite aggressive. Of course, it wasn't the best of days to start as an investor 1st of April with this Liberation Day by Trump the same week. So it's been a volatile April as an investor.
You didn't know you were going to be free of your money.
Yeah. No, but shipping stocks been actually, some of them been doing quite well. The tanker market is really good now. So I've been very long in tankers, which has been a good play because OPEC is really making a price war now. They want to get shale production down. Saudis are tired of holding back production. So we see OPEC really putting more barrels into the market, which is not good for energy stocks. So I don't have a single energy stock in my portfolio, but it's really good for freight because it creates more tanker demand.
Right.
So I'm quite aggressive, yes.
So, yeah, you play the volume price game. When volume is rising, you pay the ships. When price is rising, you pay the energy companies.
Yeah. Yeah. So right now, I think some of the energy stocks are starting to look more attractive. Oil service stocks are really hammered down. If you look at the OSX, which is the Finnish oil service index, that was launched in 1997 at an index price of 75. Today, I haven't checked, it's like 55. So you have 30 years with negative returns.
Ugh.
At one stage, this will turn, but I don't really see the catalyst right now.
Yeah, I mentioned about my interview, episode 597, Lance Depue, and he was investing in rig company and that type of thing. And I just remember seeing him he's such a smart guy. And then just to see him losing over and over again, it was just like terrifying when I think about investing in that industry. So I think you got to have a stomach for it. Let me ask you the last question, which is, what is your number one goal for the next 12 months?
I'm not really the guy who kind of plans stuff. In shipping, you don't make a lot of strategy choice. It's kind of adapt. Right now, I've been off for 3.5 weeks. So I've been kind of just settling down, reading a bit more books. I'm on a garden leave the 1st of October, so I can't really do anything for the next 5 months or so. But, I find the shipping industry one of the most interesting industry because it's such a global industry. It's a fairly small universe. Even though we transport close to 90% of the goods, it's a fairly small industry and it's a lot of interesting character. It's a very dynamic and you need to be quite kind of versatile in your skill set because what Fed is doing, what the politicians are doing, it all affects the industry. China, US trade relations, geopolitical events, it all affects it. So you really need to be on top of contemporary issues in order to be a successful shipping investor. So that's why I think that's one of the most interesting industries to be.
That's such a fascinating thing about not doing a lot of strategy, but trying to adapt to what's coming at you right today. And that's so different from so many industries. So I really, really appreciate learning that. I'm just curious, in Norway, do they have good records of ancestry? For instance, were you have been out on boats or family that's been on the sea or any interesting things in your ancestry?
Yeah, I grew up at the sea. We were always going out in boats. My grandfather, he worked for Stolt-Nielsen. Stolt-Nielsen is the biggest chemical tanker company in the world, probably. So my grandfather worked for that. I worked in the shipping industry for 20 years now. So, of course, out the window, you can look at the sea. So
it's in your blood.
Yeah.
It's in your blood. Well, listeners, there you have it. Another story of loss to keep you winning. Remember, I'm on a mission to help 1 million people reduce risk in their lives. And I think this helped us to think about how we manage our risk in the shipping industry. As we conclude, Austin, I want to thank you again for joining the mission. And on behalf of A Stats Academy, I hereby award you alumni status for turning your worst investment ever into your best teaching moment. Do you have any parting words for the audience?
Thank you for inviting again. And I will be listening in to more of your episodes.
Thank you. And I really enjoyed it myself. I think I learned a lot and I'm going to share it with my students in the Valuation Masterclass because the discussion about the valuation and all that, I think will help them understand the industry. So I appreciate that. And that is a wrap on another great story to help us create, grow, and protect our wealth. Fellow risk takers, let's celebrate that today we added one more person to our mission to help 1 million people reduce risk in their lives. This is your worst podcast host, Andrew Stott, saying, I'll see you on the upside.